Welcome to Base by Base, the paper cast that brings genomics to you, wherever you are. Okay, so think about this for a second. What if the very treatment, you know, the one designed to fight cancer, what if it actually helps other, maybe even more dangerous cells survive?
That's a provocative thought.
Right. Like, imagine a therapy. It makes a patient feel better. Symptoms improve, definitely. But underneath, it's silently letting a more aggressive version of the disease maybe take hold.
It sounds, kind of paradoxical.
It does. But it's not just hypothetical. We're talking about cancer's incredible, almost scary ability to adapt. So this constant chess game, you know, between our treatments and the cancer evolving resistance.
Relentless game, yeah.
And sometimes the drug that helps can also, act as this selective pressure, empowering new, maybe tougher mutations.
Exactly. Selecting for the fittest, even if fittest means more dangerous for the patient.
So today we're diving into a really fascinating and, somewhat counterintuitive discovery in the world of blood cancers. It throws this whole idea of adaptive resistance into sharp relief.
It really does.
How could targeting one specific pathway lead to the outgrowth of another, potentially making the disease even more aggressive? Stick around. You're about to find out. This deep dive today is possible thanks to some really groundbreaking work by a collaborative team, mostly researchers from Université Paris-Cité, APHP, Hôpital Saint-Louis, and INSERM in France.
Right, a strong French core.
But also with significant contributions from teams in the U.S., Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, and Boston Children's Hospital. So a real international effort.
Absolutely. And, you know, we should mention some key contributors like Nabi Masla, Nina Kassi, Blondine Roux, and the PIs overseeing it, Jean-Jacques Kalajian, Bruno Cassinot, and Lina Benajiba. Their work has really pushed forward our understanding of how cancer clones, these different cell populations, evolve under targeted therapy pressure.
Especially in myeloproliferative neoplasms, right?
Exactly, MPNs. That's the specific focus here.
Okay, let's set the stage a bit. Myeloproliferative neoplasms, MPNs. What are these exactly?
So MPNs are a group of chronic blood cancers. Basically, the bone marrow goes into overdrive and produces too many blood cells. Red cells, white cells, platelets, depending on the specific type.
And they're considered pre-leukemic.
That's right. They have this potential, unfortunately, to transform into more aggressive diseases like acute myeloid leukemia, AML, which is obviously much more dangerous.
And what drives these MPNs at the molecular level?
A lot of them are driven by activating mutations in a key signaling pathway called the JAK-STAT pathway. Think of it like a communication network inside the cell that tells it to grow and divide.
Okay.
And specific genes in that pathway, like JK2, CALR, or MPL, often have mutations that basically get stuck in the on position.
So if the problem is an overactive JAK-STAT pathway, well, targeting it seems logical. Which brings us to JAK's inhibitors like ruxolitinib. These came out about, over a decade ago?
Yeah, around that time. And they really did change the treatment landscape for MPNs.
Now, so what was the immediate impact?
Well, ruxolitinib, for example, it's a JAK12 inhibitor. It was, and still is, fantastic at improving quality of life. It dramatically reduces symptoms, things like severe fatigue, fevers, night sweats, and it shrinks those enlarged spleens, which can be really uncomfortable for patients.
So definite symptomatic relief.
Huge symptomatic relief. But the question lingered about its long-term impact. Does it actually change the underlying disease? Does it really improve overall survival across the board? That's been more debated.
Right. So we have drugs that work well for symptoms. But researchers suspected there might be more going on under the hood, genetically speaking, especially with long-term treatment.
Exactly. The worry was, okay, we're hitting the main driver, the JK mutation, but is that pressure inadvertently helping other cancer cells, different clones with different mutations? Are we accidentally changing the genetic landscape in ways we didn't initially predict?
Like weeding one type of weed only to have another, maybe worse one, take over the garden.
That's a pretty good analogy, yeah.
So how did this research team tackle this complex question? What was their approach?
They use a really smart, multi-pronged approach. They didn't just rely on one type of evidence. They started by looking at real-world patient data.
Okay, tell us about that cohort.
They studied 143 patients with myelofibrosis, which is a type of MPN often associated with scarring in the bone marrow. And crucially, they split this group. 72 patients had received ruxolitinib and 71 had not.
A treated group and a control group, essentially.
Right. And they didn't just look at one point in time. They performed longitudinal molecular evaluations. They used next-generation sequencing, NGS, to track the genetic changes in the cancer cells over time for each patient.
So they could see how the mutation profile evolved.
Precisely. But here's where they went a step further, and this is really cool. They use single-cell DNA sequencing on actual patient cells.
Single-cell, wow.
Yeah, this lets you see not just what mutations are present in the whole tumor sample, but which specific mutations are in which individual cells. It lets you map out the clonal architecture, the different families of cancer cells, and see how those families grow or shrink over time with treatment.
That gives you incredible resolution. So you can see if, say, a tiny population of cells with a certain mutation suddenly starts expanding.
Exactly. It moves beyond just averages. But observation is one thing. To understand the how, the mechanism, they needed experiments.
Right. You need to test causality. What did they do in the lab?
They did a lot of in vitro work experiments in lab dishes using established cancer cell lines like HEL and UK1, which have JAKE mutations, and also importantly, patient-derived cells.
And in vivo too.
Yes, also in vivo using mouse models. This combination is powerful because you can control the conditions very precisely in the lab and then see if the same effects hold up in a living organism.
What were they simulating in these experiments?
They ran competition assays. Basically, they'd mix cells with, say, a RAS mutation together with cells that didn't have it, or cells with just the original JAK2 mutation, and then expose them to ruxolitinib.
To see who wins out under drug pressure.
Exactly. See which population thrives when JK signaling is blocked. They even specifically knocked down the JAK2 gene in some experiments to really isolate the effect of inhibiting that specific target.
Very thorough.
And one more thing, they validated their findings using large public data sets like the BEAT AML cohort. This helps ensure their results aren't just specific to their patient group, but might reflect a broader biological principle. It adds a lot of confidence.
Okay, so really comprehensive strategy. Patient data, single-cell analysis, lab experiments, mouse models, large data set validation. So what did all this uncover? What's the big finding about ruxolitinib?
The headline finding is a really strong and, frankly, concerning link between ruxolitinib treatment and the rise of mutations in the RAS pathway.
RAS, like NRS, CRAS,
right.
Those well-known cancer genes.
Exactly those.
Yeah.
NRAS, CRAS, also CBL, which is part of that pathway regulation, they found that in the patients treated with ruxolitinib, there was a significant accumulation, a clonal outgrowth of cells carrying these RAS pathway mutations.
How significant?
Get this. In the ruxolitinib-treated patients, 28% of all the new mutations they detected over time were in the RAS pathway. Compare that to only 7% in the untreated patients.
Wow. Okay, that's a fourfold difference. That's not subtle.
Not subtle at all. And it wasn't just about new mutations appearing. They looked at the variant allele frequency, basically. What percentage of the cancer cells carried an existing RAS mutation?
Right, how dominant that clone was.
Exactly. And the VAF of these RAS mutations significantly increased only in the group getting ruxolitinib. This really points towards the drug actively selecting for these RAS mutated cells.
And was this effect specific to RAS, or did other mutations also increase?
It seemed pretty specific to the RAS pathway. They looked at other common mutations found in MPNs, like ASXL1, and didn't see the same pattern of outgrowth specifically linked to ruxolitinib treatment.
Okay, so the drug seems to favor RAS mutated cells.
Yeah.
But the critical question is, what does that mean for the patients? Does it affect their outcome?
And that's where the findings become really stark. Yes, it dramatically affected patient prognosis, but here's the key twist. Only when patients were on ruxolitinib.
Only in the treated group.
Only in the treated group. If you had a RAS mutation and were taking ruxolitinib, your prognosis was significantly worse. Your overall survival was lower, and your transformation-free survival was lower.
Let's break that down. Overall survival.
Median overall survival for ruxolitinib patients with a RAS mutation was about 7.6 years. For those on ruxolitinib without a RAS mutation, it was over 18.5 years.
That's a huge difference. More than double the survival time if you didn't have that RAS mutation while on the drug.
A massive difference. And transformation-free survival. Can you explain that one?
Sure. That's the time until the disease progresses into a more aggressive form, usually acute myeloid leukemia, AML, or myelodysplastic syndrome, MDS.
And the impact there was, if anything, even more dramatic. In the ruxolitinib group, if you had a RAS mutation, you had a 47% chance of transforming to AML or MDS.
Nearly half.
Nearly half. But if you had a RAS mutation and were not on ruxolitinib, your chance of transformation was only 17%.
Okay, so the combination of the drug and the RAS mutation is particularly bad news for disease progression.
It strongly suggests the drug is creating an environment where these RAS mutated clones don't just survive, they actively thrive and drive the disease towards a more aggressive state.
Which is deeply concerning. So the drug creates the pressure, but how? What's the actual mechanism? How does inhibiting JAKE help RAS?
That's what their lab experiments helped figure out. The ex vivo and in vivo work showed directly that ruxolitinib selects for these RAS mutated clones. These cells showed increased fitness, they grew better, proliferated more, even when JAK-STAT signaling was shut down by the drug.
So they didn't need the JAKE pathway anymore.
It seems they became less reliant on it or found workarounds. And the key workaround involved another major signaling pathway, the MAPK pathway.
Which is often downstream of RAS, right?
Yeah, exactly. RAS activation typically triggers the MPK pathway, which also drives cell growth and survival. The researchers found that this resistance to ruxolitinib in RAS mutated cells depended on MEPK activation.
How did they show that?
Crucially, when they experimentally inhibited the MPK pathway using MEK inhibitors, for example, the RAS mutated cells suddenly became sensitive to ruxolitinib again.
Ah, okay. So blocking JAKE selects for RAS mutants. These mutants rely on MEPK, and if you block MEK2, you restore sensitivity to the JAKE inhibitor. That connects the dots.
It really does. It shows that the MPK pathway is essential for these RAS clones to thrive under ruxolitinib pressure.
But then there was another twist, wasn't there? Something about an inverse relationship with JAK2 itself.
Yes, this was perhaps the most counterintuitive part. They found that activating the RAS-MAPK pathway, for instance, by overexpressing NRAS, actually led to decreased levels of JAK2 mRNA and protein.
Wait, so turning on the RAS pathway turned down the JAK pathway component.
Kind of looks that way. And they saw hints of this in the patient data, too. Patients whose cancers had low JAK2 expression tended to have stronger signs of RAS-MAPK pathway activity and more active cell division.
So, what's the thinking behind that? Why would that happen?
The hypothesis is fascinating. It involves something called oncogene-induced senescence, or stress. Basically, if a cancer gene like RAS becomes too active, it can trigger cellular alarm bells that force the cell to stop dividing or even self-destruct. It's a built-in safety mechanism.
Okay.
The idea is that maybe the baseline activity from the mutated JAK2, even if it's driving the cancer initially, might also contribute just enough pathway activity to keep this oncogene-induced stress response partially active in cells that also have a RAS mutation. It's like having two accelerators push partway down is actually worse for the cell than just one push down hard.
So the JAK2 activity is almost protective in a weird way, against the RAS mutation going completely wild.
Potentially, yes. So when you treat with ruxolitinib, you inhibit JAK. You take away that break or that source of stress. And that might be what fully unleashes the proliferative potential of the pre-existing RAS mutation. The RAS mutation was already there, maybe in a small clone, but it couldn't fully take off until JAK2 was inhibited.
Wow. So inhibiting one oncogenic pathway removes a restraint on another.
Yeah.
That is complex.
Deeply complex. It highlights just how interconnected these signaling networks are and how cancer can exploit these connections in unexpected ways.
This is truly a deep dive into cancer's adaptability. What are the big takeaways here for patients, for researchers?
I think the main takeaway is that JAK2 inhibition, while clearly beneficial for symptoms in MPNs, isn't a free lunch, molecularly speaking. It can create the specific selective pressure that favors the outgrowth of RAS mutated clones.
And these clones are bad news.
And these clones are associated with worse outcomes, specifically disease transformation and lower survival when under JAK inhibition. It reveals this sort of paradoxical mechanism where inhibiting one pathway allows another oncogenic pathway, which might have been suppressed or held in check, to really flourish.
You mentioned a Goldilocks principle earlier.
Yeah, it's almost like that. Maybe too much signaling through both JAK-STAT and RAS-MAPK pathways triggers cell senescence or death. But if you inhibit JAK-STAT, you might bring the RAS-MAPK signaling into a just right zone where it can drive aggressive proliferation without tripping those safety alarms.
This feels like it has immediate clinical relevance. It's not just interesting biology.
Absolutely. It strongly argues for screening MPN patients for pre-existing RAS mutations before starting them on a JAK inhibitor like ruxolitinib.
Forewarned is forearmed.
Exactly. And it also suggests that regular molecular monitoring during treatment is crucial. We need to watch out for these RAS clones emerging or expanding.
And if they do emerge, what then?
Well, that's the next challenge. But this research points towards rational combination strategies. If the resistance depends on the MEPK pathway, maybe combining the JAK inhibitor with MEK inhibitor, which targets METK, could prevent or overcome this resistance.
And you said trials for that are already happening.
Yes. Clinical trials exploring JAK plus MEK inhibition are underway. This kind of preclinical mechanistic work directly informs those next generation trial designs.
Does this principle inhibiting one pathway unleashing another potentially apply beyond MPNs?
The authors certainly suggest it might. Cancers where RAS pathway mutations are common, think pancreatic cancer, some lung cancers, melanoma could potentially exhibit similar dynamics if treated with drugs that affect related pathways.
Could it explain some mixed results with JAK inhibitors and solid tumors, perhaps?
It's possible. Or even the observation that ruxolitinib has sometimes been linked to an increased risk of certain aggressive skin cancers, which often carry RAS mutations. It underscores this major challenge in cancer therapy. Cancer is an adaptive system. You push it here, it bulges out there.
But we need to be really clear here. Despite this finding, JAK inhibitors are still valuable tools for MPN patients, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely crucial to emphasize that, yes. JAK inhibitors like ruxolitinib remain a cornerstone of therapy for many MPN patients. They provide significant symptom relief and may offer survival benefits for certain patient groups.
So this isn't about throwing the baby out with the bathwater?
Not at all. It's about refining our approach. It's about understanding the risks, identifying patients who might be susceptible to this resistance mechanism, and developing smarter strategies, maybe combinations, maybe closer monitoring to maximize the benefit while minimizing the potential downsides. It's about personalization.
And like all studies, this one had limitations that point towards future research directions.
Sure. As we mentioned, the patient cohort analysis was retrospective, looking back at records, which always carries potential biases. For example, patients who got ruxolitinib might have already had more aggressive disease. Prospective studies are needed to confirm these findings definitively.
Right, following patients forward in time.
Exactly. Also, the number of RAS mutated patients in the non-ruxolitinib group was relatively small, which limits the statistical power for some comparisons. And while their lab data hinted the selection might happen regardless of the initial MPN driver mutation, JAK2, CALR-MPL, a lot of the deep mechanistic work focused on the JAK2 V617F context. More research on how this plays out with CALR and MPL drivers would be valuable too.
Okay, so summing it all up then.
In summary, this work provides compelling evidence that while JAK inhibitors are effective tools for MPN management, they can paradoxically drive the expansion of RAS mutated clones through JAK2 inhibition, ultimately leading to more aggressive disease in those patients. It's a fascinating example of cancer's adaptive resistance and the intricate crosstalk between oncogenic pathways.
It really highlights the need to understand the entire molecular landscape of a patient's tumor, not just the most obvious driver mutation. This feels like a critical step toward truly predictive precision medicine. What does this mean for how we need to think about monitoring and adapting treatments moving forward, not just in MPN, but maybe across oncology?
It means we need to be vigilant. Targeted therapies can change the rules of the game mid-course. We need dynamic monitoring strategies, maybe using liquid biopsies to track clonal evolution non-invasively, and we need to be ready to adapt treatment based on how the cancer is responding and evolving, potentially anticipating resistance mechanisms like this one. It's about staying one step ahead in that chess match.
A challenging but crucial goal. This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this analysis, the best way to support Base by Base is to subscribe or follow in your favorite podcast app and leave us a 5-star rating. It only takes a few seconds, but makes a huge difference in helping others discover the show. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, Base by Base.